For the past 5 or 6 years, our country has been facing an economic crisis that, according to most economists, was birthed in the 1960s decision to promote home, or 1990s decision to promote home ownership to those who could not afford to own a home. And we all are realizing the situation we're in right now. I was talking to Benny about just a second ago about how much construction has slowed down, and we're in a little bit different situation than we've been in before. If we were to look past the politics of this problem that we're currently in and the crisis they're in, we would find out that the problem we're in right now basically goes all the way back to the 1960s war on poverty. And you might even look even beyond that when you go back to the social programs that were started during the Great Depression and shortly thereafter by Franklin Roosevelt. All of these little things were started as good intentions. They're all safety nets, or created to be safety nets, that were going to help the people and help society to get along better in the times, or during times of slowdown, but also they were safety nets for people who had misfortunate things happen to them. There again, these were all started based on good intentions. And if you've been following the Republican debates, and Angie and I watched the Republican debate a couple nights ago, you've probably noticed that the major concern of all people, or all the American people, is the economy. It's trumping things such as what are normal election cycle problems or issues such as abortion, homosexual rights, and even foreign policy. These things are getting very little airtime compared to the economic problems and the questions that the politicians are being asked about these things. But when you put aside the fact that our Constitution does not allow the U.S. Congress or the President to perform benevolent acts, once you get past that, you can see that we have fallen. You can see why we've fallen in such a quagmire. See, our Constitution doesn't allow for the government to do what it's doing right now. It doesn't require or allow for us to take and get involved in helping each other out, because our founding fathers knew how people were supposed to help each other out. In fact, the current system that we're under right now is really less than 60 years old. And it's this past 60 years that has caused so many problems. But when you even look beyond that, you can see that the biggest problem our politicians are facing right now is that they do not seem to want to address two fundamental economic issues or economic concept. And first, that you cannot spend more money than you make. And secondly, if you don't work, you don't eat. And if our politicians could get these things under the belt and realize and apply these, then our economic system would have to do better. It's come to the point here in America that nearly half the adults in America receive money from the government instead of paying taxes to the government. And we know that is not going to be able to be sustained. And this was not our system of government for 200 years prior to what we are right now. But America was founded on biblical principles, some of which pertain to economics. Our founding fathers and subsequent lawmakers have tried to apply some of these laws, some of the economic laws of the Bible, but they have been unable to do so because they have not seen the entire picture of the economy of Israel on how all of these things work together. In fact, many churches tried to apply certain aspects of Torah economics, but because they don't understand or are unwilling to apply it all, and quite simply, they cannot apply it all, they end up usually causing more problems and more problems than what they solve by bringing about these, you know, halfway solutions to economic problems. In this series of studies that we're going to have, probably three studies on this, we're going to investigate Israel's economic system. And we'll see that one of the fundamental principles of Israel's economic system was that of personal responsibility. In the economics of Israel, you would see that if you were poor, let me rephrase that. You are poor because of certain situations that normally you yourself cause. Now, sometimes there's unfortunate circumstances like an accident. And back in those days, you know, you could have gotten sick or, you know, any number of things. Maybe you were injured in battle. And doing things like that, you would have gotten yourself into a situation where you could actually become dependent upon other people. But in most cases, the failure of a person to be successful financially was due to things that he had done himself. He'd failed to manage his time and had failed to manage his land properly. And so God set up a number of ways to remedy that. And the remedies were that you had to work. Secondly, is that the more fortunate had to offer help. And one of the ways that they offered help was through allowing people to glean their fields. You could become an indentured servant, or you could loan your brother money. These were all part of the economic system of Israel. But the overall goal in the economics of Israel in regards to the poor, and if you actually look at the Torah laws pertaining to economics, most of them apply to how to deal with the poor. Very few of them apply to things like tithing and stuff like that. They're almost all deal with how you handle and how you work with the poor. But you will find in looking at those things that the biggest and overall goal was to lift the poor out of the poverty. It wasn't to sustain them while they were in poverty, but it's to lift them out of the poverty. And while doing so, you are to maintain the dignity of the poor person. And this is one of the key issues, is maintaining the dignity of the poor. And as we know, in our economic system today, we don't maintain the dignity of the poor. It's very undignified, some of the things that the poor have to do in order to, it's undignified the things that they do in order to receive the sustenance that the government gives to them. Yahweh's economic system is really quite simple. He owns the land, but we can use the land as long as we give him 10% of the increase and see to it that the poor are taken care of. We don't necessarily, when we're talking tithing and stuff like that, we very seldom discuss the fact that in the economy of Israel, it wasn't just giving to God, it was also taking care of the poor. Those two were combined created the economic system of Israel. God promised that if we use the land correctly, take care of his less fortunate ones, and follow his instructions, the land would produce more than we could ever use. And we see this here in Deuteronomy 28, verse 1. And it says, if you faithfully obey the voice of Yahweh your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you today, and Yahweh your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the voice of Yahweh your God. And it continues on saying, blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the field, blessed shall you be in the fruit of the womb, and the fruit of the ground, and the fruit of your cattle, and the increase of your herds, and the young of your flock. So, by obeying God in all of his economic policies, and of course, part of the overall economic plan of Israel was that you're going to obey God in what he tells you, then he says the blessings that he would be giving would overtake you. In other words, you're not going to be able to escape the blessings. They're just going to come upon you so much. You would not be able to escape all the blessings that God would give to you. Now, this obviously was given to ancient Israel, and some of us might think, well, that doesn't apply to us today. But it does apply to us today, because Yahweh is no respecter of persons. As Paul says, So Peter opened his mouth and said, truly I understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. So Peter shows, and this is the case of Cornelius, that anything that God says applies to Israel can apply to you if you walk in the ways of God. And we know the reason why, because when you start walking in the ways of God, you in fact become an Israelite. So it's sort of a circle, you might say. But he deals with everyone the same as long as these people will walk with him. Now, Yahweh intended Israel to be a theocracy, and that is a nation where the king bases everything he does on theology, is really what the word theocracy means. And so the closest we have right now to a theocracy that many of us would be familiar with would be a nation like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has a king, and he's also one of religious leaders of the nation also, and they live under a law called Sharia law that is a biblically, quote-unquote, based law. So that's what makes up a theocracy. In God's theocracy, the governmental system was basically composed of two branches. First off, of course, Yahweh was the king. God always intended to be the king over Israel. He never intended for Israel to have other kings than himself. But under the king were the shoftim, or the judges, and then there is the kohanim, or the priest. And of course, along the priests were just a subset of the tribe of Levi, and so along with the kohanim and the priests, you would include the Levites. And to the priests and the Levites were given the tithes, the sacrificial offerings, and the first fruit offerings. So basically, these guys received almost all the money. Now, there was no other tax in Israel other than the half shekel redemption tax that was given by every male Israelite when he turned 20 years old. And this became known as the temple tax. This was the tax that Yeshua and Peter were questioned about. You know, do you pay this one time or do you pay this every year? And Yeshua said, in order to not cause offense, let's go ahead and pay it, which indicates to me at least that Yeshua clearly understood Torah, that this was given one time in your lifetime. So you got the half shekel redemption tax. So you can see that the Kohanim got everything. The judges didn't get anything. The judges were just the common people who were chosen from among their clans to be the ones who make decisions for the clan. They received nothing for what they did. The Kohanim were the only ones that received money from the people. And so you would think, based on our current governmental system, that the Kohanim then would be the ones who would take care of the poor because they got all the money. But that's not the case. The Kohanim were never required to give any of the money back. There's no place in Scripture that talks about the Kohanim giving money back. Now, there's an allusion to it in the book of Malachi, but what that's talking about is that the priests were to gather up the storehouse, and then they were to distribute it to the Levites. But that's not what was happening. That was not that they were to be giving money back to the poor in any way. And also there's a question about the widows and orphans. Did the Kohanim pay them? No, that's not the case either. And we'll talk about that when we get into that down the road. The Kohanim received the tithe because they did not receive an inheritance in the land. And because they had no inheritance, they had no farm to farm. And because of the nature of their work, they had to serve at the temple or also serve within their community doing what you might call religious work. They took care of all the sacrifices and all that. So they did not have time to go out and farm as the rest of the Israelites were. Therefore, God gave them the tithe for their income. But they were in no way, like I said, required to give anything back to the people. Now, we might think that's harsh because we're accustomed to our society today. But until 1930 in this country, the government didn't give money back to the poor either. Up until 1930, the churches and other people, the cities, the communities, they took care of the poor. There is no governmental system that gave money back to the poor. So in that regards, up until in 1930s, somewhere abouts in there, we followed this system where the government did not take care of the poor. But Yahweh never intended for there to be poor people in Israel. He intended for them to carry out his Torah instructions and prosper, as is made clear by Moses in Deuteronomy 15. It says, save save when there will be no poor among you, for the Lord shall greatly bless you in the land which Yahweh your God gives you for an inheritance to possess. This is a passage that talks about the fact that there would be no poor in Israel. Now, this doesn't look like that's what it says, because it says, save when there will be no poor, which seems to indicate to us that there would be times when there would be poor, and God fully expects them to, there to be times when people would be poor. So therefore, there's going to be times when there are poor, and there will be times when there are no poor. But the save when is not part of that scripture. If you were to look in Bullinger's, in fact, some people's Bible has this italicized, the save when. Bullinger's Companion Bible has a little write-up about this little passage, and it shows that save when is not part of this scripture. So when you take the save when out, it says, there shall be no poor among you. In fact, if you were to read the Tanakh or the Septuagint, either one, the Tanakh, we use, in my usage here, I use this JPS Tanakh because it's part of my Bible Works program. And the Septuagint, if you're not familiar with the Septuagint, it's the 3rd century B.C. translation of the Hebrew Scriptures into Greek. 3rd century B.C. translation of the Hebrew Scriptures into Greek. In both of these cases, the Tanakh and the Septuagint, it makes this passage really clear because it takes the save when out. Or actually, it was never supposed to be there in the first place. And it says, there shall be no needy among you, since Yahweh your God will bless you. And in Septuagint, LXC stands for Septuagint. Actually, LXX does. For thus there shall not be a poor person in the midst of you, for the Lord, he is going to provide for you. Basically, is what it goes on to say. Just like the passage above it says. And that stands to reason, because if God says, if you follow my ways, then the blessing is going to overtake you, then would it be a reasonable thing for God to say, but there's going to be times that I can't do this. There's going to be times that I don't have enough stuff to give you. No, that's not what God says. He fully intended Israel to be prosperous in every way with no poor people at all. But Yahweh is a realist. He realized that the people aren't going to always follow him. He realized that the people are going to go to battle at times and not be fully dependent upon him. There's going to be mistakes made along the way where people are not going to walk in his way. And so he goes on in the verse in Deuteronomy 15 to say, there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore, I command you, you shall open wide your hand to the brother, to your brother, to the needy, and to the poor in your land. So even though he knows that if it was left up to him and if people would totally follow him, there would be no poor in the land. But because you guys are human beings and because you guys are going to reject my way, there's going to be times that there's going to be poor in the land. And since I know that's going to happen, I want you to know it's your responsibility to take care of the poor. So thus he set up laws by which a poor person could find relief and eventually be able to climb out of his unfortunate situation. What sets apart Yahweh's way of dealing with the poor and our way of dealing with the poor, and I say our meaning us in America, but basically every place else where they have poor, which is every place else. The difference between Yahweh dealing with poor and us dealing with the poor is that Yahweh does so in such a way to preserve the dignity of the poor. And in our system, we do not provide a way to preserve the dignity of the poor. And we'll show that as we go on. As mentioned earlier, Israel was an agrarian society and the economy was tied to the land. Each family was given an inheritance, we know that, and their inheritance depended upon their tribe, which tribe they were from. And as we mentioned in the Torah study, you know, Simeon was given a little bit smaller portion than the rest. His portion was basically tied up in the land of Judah. But nevertheless, the Simeonites, they were a smaller tribe, and so therefore they didn't need as much land. But all of the tribes were given a portion in the land for them to farm, basically, and take care of themselves. It was an agrarian society. They farmed for a living, for the most part. There were other trades, obviously, but they farmed, they raised animals to take care of themselves. One thing about the land, though, is that even though they were given a portion of land or parcel of land to use, the land never really belonged to them. The land always belonged to Yahweh, and as such, Yahweh was the landowner. The people farmed the land, so therefore the people became sharecroppers. They entered into a sharecropping relationship with Yahweh, a sort of a partnership with Yahweh. And of course, the deal was this, that Yahweh says, okay, I'm going to give you the land and I'm going to give you the rain and all of that. You farm it and you walk in my ways and I'll make sure that you have abundant crops. It was really quite simple. But the land did not belong to the Israelites. It belonged to Yahweh. And there is a reason why God did not give them the land. And I can think of at least four of those, and we'll go through those. Leviticus 25:23 says, "The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me." In other words, he's saying, you're strangers, you're sojourners, you're a ger, and the words are ger and teshav. You're a ger teshav. You're a resident alien, and you're walking with me. In other words, you're part of, you know, you and I are bound together. We're doing this together, is what he's saying. But he did this for specific reasons. First reason is that he wanted to create this sharecropping relationship between himself and the landowner. And by doing so, this provided a means by which Yahweh could claim a tithe. If he just gave him the land, then couldn't require something for him. But as a sharecropper, all of us are familiar with what sharecropping is. And as a sharecropper, the owner of the land can require something from the person who's going to farm the land. So Yahweh was able to claim a tithe from the farmer so that he could then service the needs of the Kohanim or the priest. It also provided a way where Yahweh could restore the balance on the Jubilee year. Remember, every 50 years, the land reverted back to its original owner. So by having Yahweh own the land, he can say, okay, it's in the 50 years. Now I'm going to take and give this land back to the person who originally owned it, that I originally gave it to. So it preserved the balance within Israel. It kept Israel constantly aware that they could lose the land through disobedience. There again, if you own the land yourself, then God couldn't legally take it away from you. But by him maintaining the ownership of the land, he had the legal right then to take the land back from the people if they would not walk in his ways. And thirdly, he could stipulate how the land could be used. I just bought some land north of me, about 21 acres, and I did that for the specific reason that I wanted to know how that land was going to be used. I didn't want someone trashing the land out or anything like that. I didn't know who was going to buy the land if I didn't buy the land, so I bought it in order to make sure that I could dictate how the land was going to be used from that point on. But as it is right now, I basically leased out the land because I got two people living on the land and two different families. And so they're there, but they have to now follow my edicts on that land to make sure the land doesn't get trashed out. So that's the advantage of being the land owner. Now, this final point brings us to one of the most fundamental ways God deals with the poor. One of the most fundamental ways. And that is that he told the farmer, he stipulated to the farmer that when you farm the land, you have to leave the corners of the field for the poor. And so we read there in Leviticus 19:9-10, it says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of the field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am Yahweh, your God." So if you were to look at this passage there in Leviticus 19 and you were to continue reading on, you would find that gleaning the land or failure to leave the land so that could be gleaned. Like it says, when you reap the harvest of the land, you shall wholly reap the corn. You shall not wholly reap the corners of the field. By telling the farmer to not reap the corners of the field, he is basically starting a whole list of things that he considers bad. The first thing he considers bad is a farmer who reaps the corners of his field. Other things included in this are stealing, lying. He tells the people, don't steal from one another, don't lie to one another, don't cheat one another, don't curse the deaf. He says that if you don't pay your employees on time, that's a bad thing. And there's a number of other injustices that Yahweh brings out in this point. But this is the first point in this matter. So what he's saying is that failure to leave the corners of the field or failure to leave some of the grapes on the vine is a bad thing for you, the farmer, to do. So if I were a farmer and I would realize that if I were to cut all the way to the corners of the field, that I would be cast in the same category as thieves, adulterers, liars, all these other people, I would probably think, I better not cut the corners of my field. I better leave them for the poor. So the question then arises, how big is a corner? Because remember, if he doesn't leave a corner and some of the people in his town go hungry, then he could be cast into this group of people who are liars, thieves, and so forth. So he had to know how big a corner is. He needed to protect himself and make sure he knew how big a corner was. So how big is a corner? In Hebrew, the word for corner is peah. Peah. It's a pay. Aleph, hey, payah, Strong's number 6285, and it actually simply means an edge, a quarter, a side, or an extremity. All right, well, we'll look at that and say, okay, a quarter. Well, that's one. That's 25%. Well, that's not the way it is. The word quarter is used. The word pay is translated quarter four times, and each time it talks about quarters of your land. Like when you go down to the south quarter of your land, or if, you know, in most of these instances it talks about, you know, Israel's northeast quarter would be this. Okay, so it's not a percentage of land. It just simply means, the word payah simply means edge, let's forget quarter, side and extremity, or the very edges is basically what it means. So thus there is no indication as to the amount of the field that must be left for the poor. Yet because it would be considered a crime to not leave enough to satisfy the needs of the poor, the farmer would have to make sure that he left enough. It was up to him to make that determination. So basically what we see is that it was left up to the people to decide how much you want to give to the poor, with this realization, though, the poor have to be taken care of. All right? So it's up to you to decide what you're going to do. So what that opens up is, in a local community, local setting, you could have three or four farmers get together, and this one farmer said, oh man, my crop's not doing that well. And another guy said, man, I'm having a bumper crop. I'm not going to need all of my crop, so I'll leave a bigger extremity on mine, and you go ahead and get close to the edges of yours. And the people then could work out amongst themselves how they're going to deal with the poor in their community. You see, believe it or not, that's the way it was done here in America up until about 60 years ago. Now, if we go back to this previous slide, this previous scripture, it says, when you reap the harvest of your land, you should not wholly reap the corners of the field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. The word gleanings there is the Hebrew word leket. Leket. It's a lamed kaf tet. And it means simply to glean. It comes from another Hebrew word spelled exactly the same way, except for the vowel pointing, which means to gather. So you could read that, nor shall you gather the gatherings of your harvest. But if you continue reading there and it says, and you shall not glean your vineyard, That word glean there is not the same word. It's nowhere close. It's not leket or any type of derivative of leket. That word is much different. And that word, well, this is leket, this is the gather word. That word is alal, alal. And it actually means to act severely or make a fool of someone. So going back to this previous phrase again, starting at verse 10, and you shall not make a fool of someone with your vineyard. That's what it means. Now, how would you make a fool of someone with your vineyard? You made a fool of someone by not providing enough for the poor. If the poor comes out there and there's nothing for him to get, then he is left in a desperate situation if your economy is based on the fact that you are supposed to take and provide for the poor. Now he's left up having to either beg, steal, whatever, to feed his family. So if you as a farmer do not leave enough, you are, in essence, making a fool of your brother. By not leaving enough, he is acting harshly to his neighbor and making a fool of him. And as we'll see, as we get on down into discussions of loans and things like that, when you make a fool of your brother, then God deals very harshly with you. So it's really important that the Israelite farmer leave enough for his brother. Now, though Yahweh required that the farmer leave enough for his brother, for his poor brother, he did not require the farmer to go out there and cut the wheat, gather the wheat, winnow the wheat, package the wheat, and deliver it to the poor person. He just simply said, leave it in the field. So what that means is that the poor person then has to get out there and work to get to feed his family. A little bit different than what we have to do today. Angie and I were down at Walmart the other day, and we were watching this lady in front of us. She had a whole bunch of stuff that she was buying, and some of the things, and you can sort of tell who's going to bring out their, what do they call it, Lone Star card. And we saw her pull out her Lone Star card, and it's just interesting to see how much stuff of that was going to be covered on the Lone Star card. And the cashier, though, you know, says, well, you can't buy this and can't buy that. So the person had to struggle finding enough money to buy the things that they wanted to buy, but they couldn't buy with their Lone Star card. So the hardest struggle these people had in doing these things was finding the money to buy the things that the government wasn't going to buy for them. So that's not the way it works in God's economy. In God's economy, a person has to go out and actually glean the fields. They have to go out there and gather the grain. They have to winnow the grain. They have to take and make flour out of the grain. They have to do all of this stuff themselves in order to take care of themselves. This is how they gain dignity in doing these things. They weren't given a handout. They were just given an opportunity, is all. They weren't given a handout. They were simply given an opportunity. Unlike today, where the poor are sent a check and never have to lift their hand to help themselves, Yahweh expected the poor to do everything they could to provide for themselves. You know, there's no place in the Torah, at least that I've found, that tells us that work is a minimum requirement for eating. It really doesn't say that. But if you look at the example of gleaning, it makes it very clear that work is a requirement for eating. Now, we look at the New Testament and we see Paul. And Paul makes allusions to the fact that a person has to work before he's going to eat. In 1 Thessalonians, or 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 7 and 8 says, for you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us, because we were not idle when we were with you. Here Paul was up and he had visited the Thessalonians, but he says, while I was there, I didn't mooch off you guys. He says, I was not idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it, but we toil and labor, we worked night and day, that we may not be a burden to any of you. So Paul, even though he was entitled to be taken care of because he was a guest of the Thessalonians, I mean, we don't invite people over to our house and then tell them to go out there and work in the shop for a day before you get your meal tonight. We take and honor our guests by taking and providing them food for them. Paul says that he wasn't even willing to do that. He was going to work for everything he got, even though he was entitled. And in chapter 3, verse 10, it goes on to say, "For even when we were with you, we would not give you this command, if anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat." So Paul, you know, I say this every time, Paul said nothing new. He only said things that are true. This is a Brad Scott's statement that he uses quite a bit. Paul knew it was true that a person had to eat because the Torah shows that a person has to work before they're going to eat. Even the poor have to work in order to eat. Now, the most notable example of gleaning in the Bible is that of Ruth the Moabitess, right? Ruth and Naomi, who was Ruth's mother-in-law, relocated from Moab to Bethlehem after their husbands had died. So here we have two widows. If you were to, as we go on in our study of the scripture, we'll show that the widows are taken care of, generally are taken care of a different way than other poor. But these women were both widows. Of course, Ruth was a young lady, and so she was very able-bodied. But one of the points about Ruth and Naomi is that Naomi's husband had a very close friend who was very rich. And his name was Boaz. And so you would think that Naomi, when she returned from Moab back up to Israel, and she was obviously welcomed in to the community when she came back, could go to her wealthy relative, or friend, you might say. Actually, he would have been a relative. And say, "Hey, Boaz, can you help us out some?" But that's not what Naomi did. Naomi told Ruth that she should go glean the fields, but go glean the fields of our rich relative, Boaz. And so Ruth went out and she began to glean the fields. Now, if you were to read the narrative there in Ruth, starting in chapter 2, verse 7, and read down through verse 17. I don't have it all in here. I didn't put it in here, in fact, at all. But if you were to read there, Ruth 2, 7 through 17, you'll find that Ruth gleaned the fields from morning to night. And she gleaned from morning to night in spite of the fact that Boaz had already told the other reapers to leave extra grain on the ground. Told Ruth that she could go glean from the sheaves that were already gathered. Plus, Boaz told her to take and follow the reapers. And you know, you're reaping along there, and a guy takes a sickle and he cuts part of the wheat or part of the barley. He's going to pick up some, but he's going to leave some behind. And so, by just simply following the reapers, Ruth was then able to pick up things that she didn't even have to cut. But in spite of all of this, Ruth still had to glean from morning to night in order to be able to give Naomi half of what she had in order to feed herself. Now, that was a day's sustenance, because we find that Ruth gleaned throughout the entire barley harvest and through the entire wheat harvest. So that was from the beginning of the spring festival season, Passover season, all the way through Shavuot. She was taking and gleaning. So what we see from this is that gleaning was not an easy job. Gleaning was hard on the people to do. They had to work. So there was nobody in Israel could accuse a person who provided for himself and his family by gleaning as a leech or a loafer, or what would be the good term to use, a moocher. Yeah, yeah. The gleaner couldn't do that. Because the gleaner was really having to work really, really hard to make get what he got. And I would submit that the gleaner probably worked harder than the reapers who worked for the guy, for the farmer. The gleaner probably worked harder than other people in other forms of income on a daily basis in order to be able to provide for his family. And as such, the gleaner then would have decided very shortly, this ain't a way to make a living. And so they would want to rectify the problem that would have caused them to have to glean in order to provide for their family. So in God's economy, in this very simple way of making a living, God showed that the poor never got a handout. They had to work very hard for the things that they got. And one other thing in regards to Hebrew benevolence, Israelite benevolence, and that is that the Israelite people were also supposed to be a very hospitable people also. And so gleanings were not only left for the poor, but the gleanings were also left for the ger. Remember, God told Israel that they would be a ger teshav. They would be sojourners and strangers with him in their relationship to the land. Well, a ger was a sojourner. And God says that the ger, or the sojourners, the strangers that come and visit you, can also draw from the gleanings. So in our relationship, that would be an alien who comes into our land. If an alien wants to come into the land, he has to make his living also by gleaning if he doesn't have another way to make a living. And of course, we have aliens in our country. Some of them come in here and immediately go on government sustenance. But God never allowed that to happen in Israel. So let's review real quickly here what we've seen. Benevolence was the responsibility of the people, not the government. The farmer was the first line of defense against hunger. The poor had to work to satisfy their hunger, and the purpose was to maintain the dignity of the poor. And I would submit to you that if we were to even get down back onto this most basic of ways of dealing with the poor, as Israel did, we would find a number of changes in our society, because we know that social programs in our society are what take up the bulk of the money that comes into the government. And quite frankly, government should have no part in helping out the poor. If we were back on this system, we wouldn't have the taxes we're paying right now, and thus we would be able to take care of the poor. But there are other ways also that God had the Israelites take care of each other in regards to the poor. And so we're going to get into that the next few times, next couple of times, I think we'll get through that, and we'll end up with a discussion on tithing. So, with that, shalom aleichem. Are there any questions or comments?